Chapter 17, The Resentment Button. The resentful parent expresses her disapproval or anger when she thinks she's been taken for granted. She will blame her children when they don't do what she expects, but they will never be able to fulfill her expectations because resentment is important for her to hang on to. Her anger feels justified because she thinks the parenting required for her button-pushing child holds her back from her life. She will blame her child instead of seeing that her resentment is really about something else. Her resentment keeps her protected from her shame. When she blames her child, her secret is safe. She's off the hook of having to face her pain. The resentful parent often reacts from the fear and shame of not being good enough and the responsibility to please others in her past. So when her child does not do what she expects, that old wound created when she had to do what others expected gets tapped. She may think her child needs her too much, is taking something away from her, is draining her of all her energy, or is holding her back, and certainly isn't grateful for the sacrifice. The problem escalates because the more the parent resents, the more the child demands. When the resentment button is pushed, the parent feels used, taken for granted, trapped, and depleted of her resources. Her reaction is often an attempt to get her child to leave her alone. The child of the resentful parent feels put upon, confused, and unfairly accused. When children push the resentment button, they're asking their parents to stop blaming them, own up to their own problems, so that the parents can set clear rules, expectations, limits, and boundaries. You take me for granted. Phil and Jessica, 13. "Come on, Pop, we're going to be late," were the words Phil heard his daughter yell. But her tone added, "You stupid jerk." Phil heard that tone in a lot of Jessica's sentences, and it pushed his button every time. She was running late as usual, and he was impatient as usual. He had decided that instead of yelling at her to hurry, as usual, he would go out to his shop in the garage until she was ready for school. But Jessica didn't know where he had gone, went to his truck, saw that he wasn't there, and called for him with that tone. "I never know what to do when I hear that," Phil explained. "I feel like I'm in a trap." "So what did you do?" asked Ellie, another group member. "I just took it in, muttered that I'd been out there all the time waiting for her, got in the truck and silently fumed all the way to school. This sort of thing happens all the time. I do all these things for her. It's like she's the queen and I'm her servant. It burns me up."
"So why do you keep doing them?" Ellie asked.
"I do the same thing. I don't know how to do it differently. I suppose I should sit down with her and tell her that these are the rules if I'm going to take her to school, but I never do. It's too much trouble," admitted Phil.
I suggested, "What if you just said to her at that moment, 'I don't like to be spoken to with that tone. Can you tell me what it is you want in another way?'"
"I can't do anything like that in the moment. I just hold in my anger and resentment until it passes," Phil said.
"Except that I bet it doesn't pass. For good, anyway," Ellie added.
"Right," Phil continued. "And then once in a while I'll really blow, and she cries and then doesn't talk to me, and my wife gets upset, and it's a mess."
We identified Phil's assumption. Jessica thinks I'm a stupid jerk and treats me like a lowlife. I asked him if any part of that seemed unrealistic. "Well, I suppose she doesn't really think I'm a stupid jerk," he said, "but her tone sure sounds like she has such disdain for me. She takes me totally for granted." "So it's the tone that really gets you. Do you remember being taken for granted as a child?" I asked.
"Not exactly, but I remember a time when my mother probably thought I was taking her for granted. I was watching television, and she asked me to take out the trash. I said, 'Okay,' but the next thing I knew, she stormed across the living room in front of me, trash in hand, and huffed as she slammed the door, clearly to make a point."
"What did you think?" I asked.
"That she thought I was a lazy, good-for-nothing slob, and she didn't love me anymore because I didn't do it. Her love always seemed conditional on what I did."
"And from your perspective now, what do you think your mother thought?"
"I don't know. It's possible that she asked me a few times and that there was a lot more time between her request and her storming out. Like I said, she probably thought I was taking her for granted. She always wanted me to do what she asked when she asked it. It sounds like her button got pushed and you ended up with a very sad message. What a perfect example of the gap, I pointed out. And it sounds like you might be doing the same thing with Jessica. What do you mean? He asked. When you think Jessica is taking you for granted, you storm inside with resentment. And she probably thinks something that you never intended. Her intention is probably not to take you for granted. That's your perception. Phil identified the belief he took from the trash scene and many similar incidents with his mother as, I won't be loved unless I do things for people. This translates to his parenting as, I have to do whatever my children want. And when he doesn't see clear evidence of appreciation for that, his button is pushed. So you do things for Jessica because you're afraid she won't love you if you don't, I asked. No, I wouldn't say that. It's just that that's what people who love each other do. Do you think that if you said no to her, it would mean that you were telling her you didn't love her? Well, I would know I love her, but I guess that's what I would be afraid she would think. That makes sense now. It seems a bit absurd. I know she loves me. That's the thing. In the moment of reaction, if you said to me, are you not saying no to her because she'll think you don't love her? I would say, of course not. I'm not saying no because I don't know how. I don't know how until the resentment builds and builds, and then I blow. Then I say no in a way that scares everybody. Phil thought of another piece. I also want everything to be pleasant. I don't want anyone to be unhappy. Whenever my mother was upset, I had to do something to make her happy. I thought her happiness depended on me. So the resentment builds in me when I think I'm doing all these things to make people happy, and it doesn't make them happy, or they don't think anything about it at all. They just take what I'm doing for granted. But you don't want Jessica to have to take care of you the way you took care of your mother, right? Asked Ellie. But it's that old stuff that takes over when you least expect it. Now I get it. If Phil can adjust his standard to, I can still be a good parent by taking care of some of my children's wants and saying no to others because I'm important too, he can begin to develop a healthy boundary that he never learned from his mother. With a boundary between him and Jessica, he will be able to say no and not take responsibility for how Jessica feels about his no. Then he will not blame her for his resentment. He will be honoring himself and his needs, not just hers, and a balance will result. You should know better. Catherine, Bailey, aged 4, and Alice, 14 months. Usually Bailey and Alice get along fine, said Catherine early in a class session. Bailey loves playing with her little sister. There's just one incident that keeps recurring. It's not a very big deal, but it pushes my button, and I don't really understand why. Catherine told the group that whenever the girls are playing together on the couch, and she's there with them, the same thing occurs and has been ever since Alice was born. Bailey will get on top of Alice. Alice starts making fretful noises, and I move in to tell Bailey she's too big to be playing that way and to please get off. When I'm rested and calm, I will take Bailey away and get her into another activity. When I'm impatient, I react and reprimand Bailey. You're too big, Bailey. Now get off. You should know better. Alice is too little. Bailey invariably gives one last strong nudge into Alice's stomach or back, which sets Alice off crying. It actually seems to be getting worse instead of better. What's the assumption that pops into your head when you see Bailey? I asked. That she's being a brute and she should know better. And I don't know what to do to stop it, Catherine answered. What if it's not up to you to stop it? I suggested. What if it's up to Bailey? But Bailey's only 4, Catherine said. How is she going to stop it? I asked Catherine to tell us about her own sibling situation. She is the 4th of 7 and got it from both ends. Her older siblings pushed her around, but the only intervention from her parents came when she pushed and shoved her little brother. I got labeled the brute, Catherine said, and the light dawned. Oh, my goodness, I'm passing on that horrible label, even though I don't actually call her a brute. I never realized it before. What do I do now? If Bailey's getting the message that she's bad in this situation, which is the likely result of being told she should know better, perhaps she needs to get the opposite message, I offered. You mean tell her she's being good? Catherine asked. Not good, but competent and helpful. Some time away from the couch and Alice, ask Bailey if she thinks Alice talks, I suggested.
Oh, she tells me all the time what she thinks Alice is trying to say.
Excellent, I said. Ask her what all her different sounds mean, what she sounds like when she's happy, unhappy, etc. Ask Bailey as if she is the expert interpreter, as if you need her help when you don't know what Alice is trying to say. Then, the next time the couch incident happens and Alice starts fretting, ask Bailey what she thinks Alice is saying. But you must ask with a tone of genuine curiosity, rather than with the expectation that Bailey should know that Alice is telling her to get off. If you empower Bailey to do the interpreting of Alice's fussing, rather than tell her that she's too big, Bailey's focus will shift to listening to Alice, rather than defensively reacting to your blame. She may test you a few times and say that Alice is saying she likes it. Go with it if you can until Alice's sounds are so obvious, and then ask Bailey again what she thinks. It will be hard to not jump in to protect Alice. If it gets too rough, pick Bailey up and take her in the other room, but refrain from the all-too-familiar lecture. The next week, Catherine couldn't wait to share. She had talked to Bailey about Alice's language, and Bailey was only too happy to inform her mother of all the words and phrases only she could hear in Alice's talk. Well, the couch scene happened again, and I lay down with them, all prepared to do what you said. As the scene familiarly played, I lay there watching the same pattern unfold that happened with me and my mother. I began recalling scenes. Not only did my mother call me the brute, but she also called me dumb. Catherine described her mother as living under the intellectual shadow of her father, who had scored in the genius range on his IQ test, and often reminded them of this fact. She said that her mother tried to keep up, always doing the New York Times crossword puzzles, but continually fell short. Her husband always knew the answers that she didn't. Catherine finally understood as an adult that it was to make herself feel superior that her mother ridiculed her for being dumb, not very bright, and having a few loose marbles. It took Catherine many painful years before she learned that this wasn't true. As I lay there on the couch remembering all this, it became extremely clear to me how important it was to turn this around and instill competence and ownership in Bailey, so I became more focused than before. I told Bailey that it was up to her to interpret Alice and to decide for herself what was the right thing to do. Bailey started saying things like, "I think Alice is telling me something, Mommy. I know what she's saying. She's telling me to kiss her cheek and shake her hand and blow a kiss to Mommy." And she started doing those things. But, Catherine continued, the most amazing thing was the piece that I had completely missed by being so focused on Bailey's bad behavior. I couldn't believe my eyes, but it was true. As I watched two or three of these couch scenes from a new perspective, I saw how 14-month-old Alice, little innocent Alice, was actually setting her sister up. I saw that Alice's fretting began soon after they got on the couch, before Bailey did a thing to her. She had learned how the scene was going to unfold in her favor. But when I handed the situation over to Bailey and stayed out of it altogether, Alice stopped making the fretting sounds, and the incident disappeared completely. Catherine deeply resented her siblings for the labels that got fixed upon her. She projected her resentment directly onto Bailey by accusing her of bullying her little sister. Even though Bailey was only 4 and shouldn't have known better, Catherine's projection gave her justification for the blame. She became more and more conscious of her assumption that Bailey was being a brute each time the scene happened. Catherine was appalled that the words she hated so much were the very words she was thinking about her own child. She saw clearly how her belief, "I am too big and too dumb," played right into creating the pattern with her own daughter. Because she'd done so much work on relearning who she was, that she was not a brute, not dumb, that these were her mother's issues, not hers, Catherine was able to break this last link quickly. Why do I always have to be the one? Sally and Andrew, aged 7. Why is it always me?
Why do I have to be the one to change, be understanding, do everything? Why can't anyone ever do something for me for a change? Sally was angry as she sat in class listening to advice on how to empathize with a child's feelings and point of view. I'll tell you exactly what my agenda is all about and what message I'm sending with it. My agenda is loaded with anger, stress, and resentment every single morning. My intention is to get Andrew off to school, clothes on, teeth brushed, and on the bus. His younger sister gets herself ready just fine, but he can't do a thing without a prod up his butt. He'd let me breathe for him if I could. There's going to be nothing left of me. What he hears is, "Hurry up and get down here. Why haven't you brushed your teeth yet? Stop drawing. Turn off the TV. Get your clothes on. How many times do I have to tell you?" I know that, but he still should do it. Another parent in the class chuckled and said, "That sounds like my house every morning. He knows how to do all this. He's just being obstinate to get my goat. He's so damn lazy. Now, why can't I expect him to do this? This is not rocket science for a 7-year-old.
When I suggested trying to connect by reflecting back to him that he's having a hard time getting it together, that he would much rather draw or watch TV, and that it's hard to get up and off to school when he doesn't want to go, Sally looked disgusted. "You know what," she said, "that's just pop psychology. That's just being manipulative to get him to do what I want him to do in the first place. It's giving over my control and authority to a kid. I know trusting him and listening to his side feels very strange. It's like a foreign language to those of us who never experienced it growing up," I said. "And it seems at first like we're letting our kids get away with anything they want." As we got into background, Sally revealed a story that explained her resistance to Andrew. Her childhood was lonely and dismal. Her parents' attention was paid to her brother, 18 years older, who was sick and expected to die. He did die when Sally was 18. Her entire childhood was about taking care of the household, both emotionally and physically. Sally can't tolerate doing it for her children as well. It should be her turn now. She feels drained of every shred of herself. She's afraid that to give any more, there will be nothing left. At this point, she sees her needs as much greater than Andrew's, and she resents any suggestion to give him any more. "No one ever did this stuff for me. Why should I do it for him? How come it's always me who has to give?" she said resentfully. Perhaps to keep Sally where she needed her, her mother gave Sally the message that her hopes were futile and her ambitions unrealistic. Sally lost herself in television and dreamed of one day having the perfect family. "The Donna Reed Show and the Partridge Family combined," she said. To everyone's amazement, Sally added, "And now I pretty much have that, and I feel guilty about it because I don't think I deserve it." I wonder if you nag and yell at Andrew to unconsciously prevent yourself from being like Donna Reed. That way you can maintain your comfort zone and not have more than you deserve, I pondered out loud. "Well, that's an interesting thought," Sally said. "Better than having a child who's seriously ill, I suppose." The following week, Sally came into class and said, "Well, do I have a story for you?" We were enthusiastic to hear. The other night, Andrew was dropped off at home right at supper time after a class field trip. He stormed in the door and said, "I don't want to eat with you. You never have any food I like. I don't want to talk to you. I hate you." Andrew at his best. I don't know whether it was because I had had the afternoon without him or because his ranting seemed so ridiculous, but I stayed perfectly calm. I didn't yell at him once. I said, "We're eating now, so you'll have to go in the other room and draw or something if you don't want to join us and be civil." He sputtered, "I can't draw. I'm a terrible drawer." But he did go in the living room. All during dinner, I planned what I was going to say. You would have been proud of me. I even wrote it down. After dinner, I went over to the table where he was and sat down next to him. Here's the dialogue. Me: "It sounds like you're having a tough day." Sally smirked at her skill. Andrew: "I am. It was just awful." Me: "Well, what was so bad about it?" Andrew: "The bus ride was noisy." Me: "Who did you sit with?" Andrew: "I was all by myself." Me: "On the way home or going to the butterfly park?" Andrew: "At the butterfly park. No one wanted to sit with me.
His face started to crumple.
Me. That sounds sad. Would you like to come sit on my lap?
He nodded his head yes, crawled onto my lap, and began to cry.
Me. It's sad when no one wants to sit with you, isn't it?
Andrew.
Yeah, but that's not all.
None of the butterflies landed on me. They landed on all my friends, but none landed on me.
We continued to talk about who they landed on and why, and we made a plan to go back when he had on a different color shirt.
Now, here's the interesting part. At this point, I looked up for the first time and saw our reflection in the sliding glass door across the room. My stomach had begun to feel queasy when he said he sat alone, but when I saw the reflection of the two of us together, I got really nauseous. I thought I was having a panic attack. I got dizzy and put my head in my hands. I finally asked Andrew to get up because I felt sick and I had to go to my room. The dizziness didn't go away. Then I thought I was having a heart attack. It was overwhelming. I didn't feel dizzy the next morning, but I haven't felt really right since. It was the strangest sensation I've ever had. The room was silent and spellbound. Wow, was all anyone uttered. If I had reacted the old way, which would have been pretty bad considering how awful Andrew was when he came in, I would never have found out about him being alone or about the butterflies. I guess the butterflies went to my stomach. After some supportive comments from the group, during which time I gathered my thoughts together, I said, "I think what you saw in that reflection was a picture of what you have always longed for. You saw yourself holding and comforting Andrew, what you wanted someone to do for you." Sally stared at me, nodding silently, holding back her emotion. "I wonder if that longing was too painful for you to acknowledge, so your body reacted physically to keep you from feeling the emotional pain. It will be good to let that pain in little by little." Sally's assumptions were that Andrew was out to get her and was draining her of her life energy, which caused her to feel resentful and enraged when he wouldn't do what she asked. Because of her belief that she was responsible for everything and worth nothing, she transferred it into her standard, which said, "Children should do what is expected of them with no complaints." But her belief still led her to think that she was responsible for everything he did, so her resentment grew and grew. She didn't want to be responsible anymore, and Andrew seemed to be all that was holding her back. We all encouraged Sally to keep up her empathic work with Andrew, saying that it would be her path to her own healing. She will probably feel pain along the way, but it will be better to have it out in the open where it can dissipate rather than fester inside to instigate her resentment. If she's able to give Andrew what she so deeply needed, she will feed that part of herself where the pain resides, her button. When she can hold Andrew with understanding and unconditional acceptance, not only will his resistant behavior lessen, but she will give herself what she's giving him.